Hi, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, June 8th, 2017.
Although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI.
FBI has been in turmoil. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that.
By saying that the organization was in disarray. Those were lies, plain and simple.
I had a dinner with him. He wanted to have dinner.
And the president begins by wanting to talk about my job.
And he wanted to stay on as the FBI head. And
so I'm sitting there thinking, wait a minute, three times you've already asked me to stay or talked about me staying.
And I said, I'll consider, we'll see what happens. But we had a very nice dinner.
He's looking to get something in exchange for granting my request to stay in the job.
A dinner was arranged. I think he asked for the dinner.
Did you in any way initiate that dinner?
No. I've seen the tweet about tapes. Lordy, I hope there are tapes.
Did you at any time urge former FBI Director James Comey in any way, shape, or form to close or to back down the investigation into Michael Flynn?
No. Next question.
I took it as a direction. I mean, this is the President of the United States.
This Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse.
But what I think he meant by the cloud was the entire investigation is taking up oxygen and making it hard for me to focus on the things I want to focus on. The ask was to get it out that I, the President, am not personally under investigation.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. History in the making. Possibly prosecutable allegations now on the record. Comey v. Trump is not yet a court case, but it is a political confrontation unparalleled in the history of the young 21st century, and maybe even beyond. As you heard there, James Comey, former FBI director, spoke of his firing, his strange and awkward and possibly impeachable encounters with President Donald Trump, and Comey spoke eloquently about the whole case of Russian intervention in the 2016 election. As for the historical context of this remarkable day, let me give you a quote from the last century. Quote, "And if these allegations prove to be true, what they were seeking to steal was not the jewels, money, or other precious property of American citizens, but something much more valuable, their most precious heritage, the right to vote in a free election." That quote is from the late Senator Sam Ervin, talking about the Watergate burglar. Senator Sam Ervin, who was at the center of the hearings that ended in the resignation of President Richard Nixon back in 1974. Lots to talk about this hour. Joining me from Washington is Amy Sabrin, retired partner from the law firm Skadden, Arp, Slate, Meagher & Flom, where she represented many public officials and executives in the Department of Justice and congressional investigations. She's in Washington, D.C. Amy, your impressions of what you've heard on this very historic day?
Well, John, I think we witnessed some very significant history today. We heard the former director of the FBI say that the President of the United States could not be trusted to tell the truth, and therefore he felt compelled to memorialize his meetings with the president. The other thing that I don't want to lose focus on while we're discussing things such as obstruction of justice is that the president's repeated meddling in an ongoing investigation is highly abnormal and is universally understood to be inappropriate. And the president surely understood that. Because he made such a fuss during the campaign about Loretta Lynch's meeting with Bill Clinton. So he understood that even having relatively brief and benign conversations with a public official conducting an investigation is inappropriate.
Well, there's a great exchange with the Senator Mark Warner talking specifically about the idea that, here's James Comey making a character evaluation of Donald Trump and suggesting that he might lie.
What was it about that meeting that led you to determine that you needed to start putting down a written record?
A combination of things. I think the circumstances, the subject matter, and the person I was interacting with. Circumstances first, I was alone with the President of the United States, or the President-elect, soon to be President. The subject matter, I was talking about matters that touch on the FBI's core responsibility and that relate to the President, President-elect, personally, and then the nature of the person. I was honestly concerned that he might lie about the nature of our meeting, and so I thought it really important to document. That combination of things I'd never experienced before, but it led me to believe I got to write it down, and I got to write it down in a very detailed way.
How important is that, especially since Comey was asked if he ever had that suspicion of President Obama or even George W. Bush, both of whom he worked for?
Well, I think it's significant in and of itself, the sheer number of communications he had with President Trump in the course of 4 months. He reported 9 one-on-one communications. In the course of 4 years, he had 2 such communications with President Obama.
Let's talk about the idea of where Robert Mueller is going to go in his investigation. Based on what we've heard today, would you say there's no question that obstruction of justice is going to be one of the targets of the special counsel's investigation?
I believe it will be. Certainly, Mr. Comey's testimony contained the building blocks of a potential obstruction charge. First of all, the chronology is key. You have to look not only at the president's words to Mr. Comey, but what was happening around them. And one significant fact that gets glided over sometimes is that on January 26th, the acting attorney general, Sally Yates, informed the White House counsel that not only did DOJ have evidence that Michael Flynn had lied to Vice President Pence about his conversation with the Russian ambassador, but significantly here, that Flynn had been interviewed by the FBI the day before. So she comes and delivers that information to the White House on the 26th, and the very next day, President Trump invites Comey to an unprecedented private dinner in which he repeatedly asks if he wants to keep his job and says he expects loyalty. Second, another significant building block that comes out of Comey's testimony is that the president repeatedly requested that these conversations be held in secret. Third, as I said, there's the sheer volume of contacts. And finally, the president ultimately did fire Comey and said that he did it because of the Russian matter.
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm, you know, very lay here. If someone is investigating you on a subject that you think is inappropriate, and then you fire them, and it turns out that, you know, that investigation involves you in something that is perhaps a high crime and misdemeanor or even just a crime. That is obstruction of justice, isn't it? You fire somebody who's trying to get you.
Well, you have to be have a motive of what the statute calls corrupt intent, the intent to do it for a bad purpose. The intent that the courts sometimes describe it as that the conduct would have the natural effect of interfering with the investigation. That being said, Mr. Comey's statements and testimony have some building blocks that the president could use here in his defense, one of which was his statement that he wanted to lift the Russian cloud because it was interfering with his ability to act on behalf of the country. So he could argue that his motive wasn't corrupt. It wasn't to interfere with the investigation. It was to get on with the business of governing. And the second building block in his defense would be, as Senator Rubio pointed out, that he used the word, "I hope you can drop the Flynn investigation." And he only asked Comey to disclose, as again, Senator Rubio pointed this out, he asked Comey to disclose publicly that which he had already told the president and congressional leaders, that the president himself was not the subject of a counterintelligence investigation.
Legally, that doesn't eliminate the possibility that he was under investigation. It just means not on counterterrorism. And the word personally was used. Does that narrow things and that there could be other investigations that Trump was being investigated for, but this word personally, it makes it a little bit ambiguous?
I think that's correct. And I think Mr. Comey even pointed out that some people in his senior leadership group felt that there was a possibility that the investigation could expand to include the president because they were investigating his campaign. And after all, he was the candidate and the head of the campaign and didn't want Mr. Comey to tell the president that.
Because I'm such a history nut, I couldn't resist using that Sam Ervin quote talking about the Watergate burglars. In this particular case, we're talking about Russians interfering with the elections. How much does that increase the voltage of this investigation versus other investigations of sitting presidents, in your view?
Well, I think it would be unprecedented. I don't know that any sitting president has ever been implicated or suggested or investigated for the fact that he or anybody reporting to him or working for him was colluding with a foreign power to disrupt an election.
So the stakes are higher here.
Yes.
Absolutely. The question of how many times Comey had one-on-one discussions or awkward encounters with the president, how alarming is that to you, or surprising is that to you, or you know, in your legal career, how does that fall outside of what you would have expected?
It's very surprising. I have actually represented a president of the United States. I represented Bill Clinton. I represented a Republican Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, in investigations. And I've never seen this level of interaction on a specific investigation. You know, on general law enforcement policy is one thing, but on a specific investigation, let alone one involving the president himself or people who report to him or work for him, it's unprecedented. And as I said before, it's universally understood to be highly abnormal and inappropriate because it undermines public confidence in the integrity and independence of the agencies charged with a fair and impartial administration of justice. And it taints the results of this particular investigation, regardless of its outcome.
Before we go, let's listen to the short 22-second cut of James Comey talking about why he was fired, the reason that was given, all the coverage I remember giving to that Rosenstein memo, that it was a lie, pure and simple. Listen.
And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple.
What do you think that means, that Rosenstein, within the Department of Justice, was made to write a memo that he perhaps knew was a lie?
That's one of the mysteries here, and I'm sure this is something Mr. Mueller will be investigating, the circumstances surrounding Mr. Comey's firing.
Amy Sabrin is a retired partner from the law firm Skadden Arps. She represented many public officials and executives in the Department of Justice and congressional investigations. And we're hearing from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Hello, I'm looking at Mr. Comey, and he's telling the truth. He's not hesitating. He's not squirming around. And the best thing he's saying so far, no other country should tell America how to think.
This is Laura from Camas, Washington. This isn't so much an accounting of James Comey or even an accounting of Donald Trump, but it's more a criticism of the American people and their lack of information and knowledge in voting for this man.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, helping small business owners get started with incorporation, LLCs, DBAs, and nonprofits, while providing ongoing legal advice through its network of independent attorneys. More information available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway.
Returning now to our top story, the historic testimony by James Comey before the Senate Intelligence Committee. If that was Act 1, 2, and 3 of a Shakespearean saga, tragedy, comedy, call it what you will, Act 4 was the president's personal attorney responding.
Contrary to numerous false press accounts leading up to today's hearing, Mr. Comey has now finally confirmed publicly what he repeatedly told President Trump privately. That is, that the president was not under investigation as part of any probe into Russian interference. The president, Mr. Comey also admitted that there is no evidence that a single vote changed as a result of any Russian interference. Mr. Comey's testimony also makes clear that the president never sought to impede the investigation into attempted Russian interference in the 2016 election.
His personal attorney, Mark Kasowitz, had an extensive statement that he delivered to the White House press corps in Washington, D.C. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, observed that statement, as did so many of the rest of us. First of all, Todd, your impressions.
Well, you have the president's personal lawyer and not the White House counsel. We should draw that distinction. That, to many people, will be a fine distinction, but in terms of the law, it's an important one. If there ever were a case where Donald Trump were being investigated for obstruction of justice or collusion or any of the other things that have been possibilities in this ongoing confrontation, it would be his personal lawyer and his personal legal fortunes that would be at stake there. So that's part of the distinction there.
So just to interrupt for a moment, people should not conclude, even cynics should not conclude, that because this is the president's personal lawyer, that nobody in the administration would defend him. That's not what's going on here at all. This is normally how this was done.
No, I hesitate to describe any of what's going on as normal.
Yeah, that's good.
But under a legal framework, from this journalist's perspective, it would not be unusual for a personal lawyer to be involved in this way and not a White House counsel. But it was a very lawyerly and fairly incendiary statement from Mark Kasowitz that he made at the National Press Club, John, not only accusing James Comey of being sort of a common leaker for his own admission that he took his memos and his recollections of his discussions with the president and sent them to a friend with the idea that it would be leaked to the press, but much more glaringly, a quote from Kasowitz saying that the president never in form or substance suggested or directed Mr. Comey to stop investigating anyone, including suggesting that Mr. Comey, quote, let Flynn go. Now, that's a direct challenge to James Comey's sworn testimony, saying that James Comey lied.
All right, let's take those in order. First of all, the idea James Comey, according to Mark Kasowitz and according to Donald Trump, the president of the United States, is a common leaker. Let's play, first of all, the exchange with Senator Susan Collins at the Comey testimony, where Comey admits to sharing with a colleague information which essentially triggered the appointment of a special counsel.
I woke up in the middle of the night on Monday night, because it didn't dawn on me originally, that there might be corroboration for our conversation. There might be a tape. And my judgment was I needed to get that out into the public square. And so I asked a friend of mine to share the content of the memo with a reporter. Didn't do it myself for a variety of reasons, but I asked him to because I thought that might prompt the appointment of a special counsel. And so I asked a close friend of mine to do it.
And was that Mr. Wittes?
No. No.
Who was that?
A good friend of mine who's a professor at Columbia Law School.
Now, let's hear what Kasowitz said about that. You said a moment ago, common leaker is how he was referred to. It's actually much more insulting even than that. Listen to what Kasowitz said.
And from before this president took office to this day, it is overwhelmingly clear that there have been and continue to be those in government who are actively attempting to undermine this administration with selective and illegal leaks of classified information and privileged communications. Mr. Comey has now admitted that he is one of these leakers. Today, Mr. Comey admitted that he unilaterally and surreptitiously made unauthorized disclosures to the press of privileged communications with the president.
Strong words, again, from the president's personal lawyer, not a prosecutor. You would expect him to use words that are as strong as possible in defense of his client, who is Donald Trump. Part of the entire political pushback, John, on the idea of the Russian investigation, election meddling, or even cooperation, collusion, or alignment at any level in this investigation from the White House and from their allies has been attacking leaks, not often attacking the veracity of the news itself, although the president has accused people of trafficking in fake news, saying that the entire Russia investigation was fake news at one point, but attacking the leaks and the leakers themselves. So this seems to be of a piece with that strategy. James Comey answered that question in the committee and said that these were his personal recollections of a conversation that he had, that they weren't classified, and that he had every right to put them out when he was no longer FBI director.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, on the White House response, President Trump's personal lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, responding to the testimony of former FBI Director James Comey, perhaps raising more questions than it answers. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
The cliffhanger in Britain we've been reporting on all week may have become more of a close call for British Prime Minister Theresa May. May's decision to hold elections 3 years ahead of schedule to gain a bigger parliamentary majority and a stronger hand for the Conservative Party in upcoming Brexit negotiations may actually make things more difficult for the Tories. But it's still been a tightening race with a strong showing from opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. Tim Bale is a professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London, and he says May's gamble looks a little reckless as voters go to the polls.
She hasn't fought a particularly impressive campaign. She called this election in order to increase her majority, which was pretty slim in the House of Commons. If she doesn't improve it by 30, 40 seats, I think most Conservatives will wonder whether it was worth calling the election in the first place. And it might make it a little bit more difficult to get the legislation that she needs to get through for Brexit.
How much does she need more of a cushion in Parliament to have flexibility on Brexit?
It's difficult to calculate the numbers precisely, but there are about 30 Eurosceptic ultras or headbangers, as they're sometimes called, who would really prefer us to completely crash out of the EU without any kind of deal. Most Conservatives, it has to be said, don't want that outcome. If her majority is still a slim one, then she is going to be dependent on those people, and that will make it a lot harder to actually compromise with the EU and get some kind of free trade deal with it. So she really is going to be looking, I think, still at a majority of about 50 or so to retain that kind of cushion that she was looking for.
Were you one of the folks who, when Corbyn was running last time against Cameron, who viewed Corbyn as someone with no new ideas, who was absolutely bereft of an ability to inspire the nation, and now, boom, we've seen something completely different?
Well, I was certainly a Corbyn skeptic, I will admit. But what he has been able to do is not necessarily inspire the nation, but inspire a particular part of the nation. He seems to have mobilised Labour's base, and Labour's base in particular among people who haven't voted before and among young people, much as, if you like, Bernie Sanders was able to do in the Democratic primaries in the United States. Whether that will actually do him much good in a general election, however, is another matter, because, of course, one thing we know about people who don't usually vote is they don't usually vote. And one thing we know about young people, particularly in this country, they don't vote that much either. So getting them to the polling stations and actually getting them to cast a ballot may be difficult. That's why, although the election looks as if Labour has been closing on the Conservatives, I'm not sure it'll be quite as close as everybody thinks.
And what's the chance of a huge surprise like Brexit? And what, if anything, is going to cause this tightening momentum to plateau?
Well, I mean, I think there's always a chance. I mean, you know, Brexit was a surprise to many people. The election of Donald Trump was a surprise to many of us, at least over here. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to write it off completely. In terms of what will actually block Labour's momentum, I think it will probably be when people go into the ballot box and close their eyes and think whether they can imagine Jeremy Corbyn as the Prime Minister of this country. And I think when it comes down to that decision, many people will flip over to Theresa May, even if they like some of the policies that the Labour leader has been talking about over the last 2 or 3 weeks.
It's curious, this result, that even though the terrorism incident seemed to accelerate the closing of the polls, when separate polling was done on who has confidence in whom regarding security, May clearly won that one.
She did clearly win that one, but she also has a record to defend. And in some ways, unfortunately for her, she was Home Secretary and therefore in charge of policing and in charge of security, and therefore is vulnerable to the accusation made by Labour that she underfunded those services for the last 5 or 6 years due to the Conservatives' austerity policies. So the Labour accusation that something more needed to be done and rather sooner, I think, does have some traction. On the other hand, of course, her criticisms of Mr. Corbyn as being soft on terrorism, he's voted against every single piece of anti-terror legislation in his career in Parliament, which is a long one, and he's on record as being opposed to Shoot to Kill, although he denies it now, probably does play against him.
Professor Bail, we are so used to in the United States focusing on the personalities of candidates, who you want to have a beer with, those kinds of things. But, you know, ultimately, it's get out the vote. And who's got the better machine here?
In that respect, I think we see two quite different parties. The Labour Party has put on a lot of members over the last 2 or 3 years, and it's the contention of those activists that that will make a big difference. In other words, they've got boots on the ground that the Conservative Party hasn't got. I think the Conservative Party is in trouble in terms of membership. Its members are slightly older and slightly less active than Labour members. But what the Conservative Party does have is an effective machine, quite a lot of money to spend, particularly on digital advertising. So we're seeing, in some senses, two different models of campaigning here. We're seeing membership versus money, if you like, and I think money in the end may well make the difference.
Tim Bail is a professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London. He spoke with us from London. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thanks a lot.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. You know, there's nothing in the Federalist Papers about Twitter, but the microblogging platform has certainly helped define Donald Trump's presidency. Nevertheless, last week, in response to Trump's justification for his Paris climate change agreement decision, a Twitter user responded, quote, "Greetings from Pittsburgh, sir," and then asked sarcastically, "Why didn't you attend your hashtag Pittsburgh not Paris rally in D.C., sir? Hashtag fake leader." Trump blocked this user with Twitter tools available to anyone. This week, though, free speech advocates representing Twitter users who have been blocked sent an open letter to President Trump. They argue that blocking those users is a violation of the U.S. Constitution. Katie Fallow is one of those advocates representing Trump-blocked users, a senior attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
So is this letter it's not a lawsuit, or you're not filing anything against the president at this point?
Correct. It's akin to a demand letter where we are asking the president to stop unblocking users based on their viewpoint. And if the government doesn't take action, then we would explore the possibility of litigation.
Can't Twitter just unblock them?
No, this is not a lawsuit against Twitter. This is asking the government, and it's directed at the way that the president uses his Twitter account. So we wouldn't necessarily have any jurisdiction over Twitter, and also this is not aimed at Twitter. It's the way that the president or any public official uses their Twitter account.
You are saying that the way the president has used Twitter would be different from me attempting to block somebody.
Absolutely.
Why is that?
Because he's a public official and he's using it for his public duties. He uses it to express his thoughts on policies, to announce important policy decisions like when he announced the new director of the FBI yesterday, and to engage with the public in a very lively debate with his tens of millions of followers. And as Sean Spicer said yesterday, his tweets are statements of official policy.
But nothing about the U.S. Constitution or this Twitter blocking would prevent this user that you represent and the other users you represent from, you know, taking out an ad in a newspaper or buying a billboard that would say the exact same thing or in fact, writing a letter to the editor in any other way, expressing their speech in exactly the same words, right?
That's true. This impacts their speech on Twitter, and it both prevents the blocked user from seeing the president's tweets and also prevents that user from participating in the comment threads in which all of the Twitter users, the members of the public, discuss the policies. I think the sort of the best analogy here is a city council meeting that has a part of it open for audience participation. And sure, you know, the courts have long held that that audience participation part is what they call a designated public forum, and you can't tell people that they can't speak there or they don't have a right to speak there because of their views.
Where do you think we're headed in this Twitter universe regarding the First Amendment?
I think it's very important that every time a new form of communicating comes about, that we have to remember the way to apply these basic First Amendment principles. Although this is a demand letter to President Trump, this would apply to any government official or government body that uses a social media account for the purpose of conducting government business and allows for public participation. There are instances around the country of, for instance, city council members having a Facebook page and not allowing certain people to post comments because of their viewpoints. We're not saying that you can't establish reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions, but you just can't suppress speech because it's critical.
Katie Fallow is a senior attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The whole war on obesity is a war on people.
It's not going to be easy. It's going to be an uphill battle.
We are really not healthy.
I want to be taken seriously, no matter what my weight.
So you're always in like this low-level crisis, pitting your regular bills against whether or not you're going to buy healthy food for your kids.
So obesity is a complex disease.
The question is, do we have an environment that supports responsible decision?
And is a greater public health challenge than anything else, in any virus, any other disease, and even terrorism.
I say hunger, and you say, what's for lunch? Hunger, you see, is like yawning. It's overpowering. It's contagious.
When I feel just, like, hungry, I feel like I'm so, like, sad and all droopy.
When you and your family are hungry, we are all adapted to choose the quickest, closest way of dealing with one of the key mechanisms of human survival. Unfortunately, in a world of abundance, when hungry, low-income families have limited options and time and healthy foods are not close by or even available at a reasonable cost, it's the starchy, high-calorie, low-price options that end up satisfying that hunger craving. One in six Americans report being persistently hungry at least once a year. And in 2012, 48 million Americans were classified as food insecure in the world's richest nation. Tracy McMillan is an independent journalist covering hunger for the National Geographic and author of The American Way of Eating. Mary Harris from WNYC's Health Desk and the podcast Only Human and McMillan bring us their conversation as part of our series on obesity this week on just why the federal government started to monitor food insecurity in the first place.
So that change, I think, was to reflect the reality of life in the U.S., which is that we do produce enough calories for everybody in this country. Like, that does happen. The difference is now is that because of the way that wages are distributed, right, a lot of people don't really have enough money to buy really healthy diets all the time. So what happens is people stock up a lot on starchy food that won't go bad. It also means that, you know, at the start of the month, people will buy more fruits and vegetables. And then after that first flush of money from SNAP, they sort of go, oh, this is great. I've got grapes or oranges. This is so wonderful. And then the money starts to peter out and they're like, oh, well, I can't really do that anymore. It's back to mac and cheese and tater tots. And I also certainly came to understand, you know, I spend a lot of time in New York and have done a lot of reporting here. And the social services delivery system here is incredibly sort of forward-thinking and sophisticated. And you have all these nonprofits that are bringing in fresh fruits and vegetables into food pantries. And around the rest of the country, that's actually very unusual. So most food pantries in the U.S., it's still Cheerios, spaghetti, canned green beans, frozen starches, anything like that, just anything that will be stable. And something that I also came to really appreciate is that when emergency food provision developed in the U.S. in the 1980s under Reagan, the idea was that it was an emergency, right? That this was a temporary problem that a family was going to face and you just had to get them some food, any food, and then the crisis would pass. And what has come to happen is that because our wages don't match the cost of living, families end up depending regularly on what we call emergency food provision, right?
So it becomes like a low-level emergency all the time.
Yeah, so you're always in like this low-level crisis, pitting all your regular bills against whether or not you're going to buy healthy food for your kids.
Can you tell me a little bit about the families that you met?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was really most struck by a family outside of Houston in the suburb of Spring. The mom was named Jackie Christian, and she was a single mother of two boys. She was in a homeless shelter program, so she and her boys were staying in a different church every week. And so she would get up at, you know, 5:36 in the morning, get them to school, and then her day, right, would be spent going from different home health aid appointment to different home health aid appointment to, you know, the welfare office or social services office to help her figure out paperwork and then talking to a payday loan officer and this whole thing. So she was incredibly sophisticated at knitting all of this stuff together, but she was making, you know, $7-$8 an hour as a home health aide. And so she didn't really have that much money, I mean, for food or for, you know, for decent housing and so on and so forth. And we actually had what for me was a pretty intense experience where, you know, we'd spent this whole day driving around. So we're in the car for like 13 hours and we pick up the boys and it's getting late. And we're still about half an hour from the shelter. And the 8-year-old, he wanted fried gizzards and okra, right? I mean, because we're down in Houston. And so we went and we stopped at a fast food place, and she didn't have enough money to pay for it. And so it was something where she had to go through like 3 different declined credit cards. And then we drove back to her mom's house because she'd already ordered the food. And, you know, she borrowed $10 from her mom so she could go back and get, you know, what's essentially junk food to feed the kids, right? And I think this is something most parents can identify with, right? Like when your kid is really hungry and stressed out and you just need to take care of them.
So heartbreaking, though.
Yeah. I mean, and I was like, okay, so this is not that Jackie doesn't understand, you know, fried gizzards and okra is not health food. This is not that she doesn't understand budgeting. This is, you know, she's a stressed out mom with a kid. And so she goes through this whole process to feed him, even though, right, that kind of food, right, is obviously not the healthiest thing.
You know, you did talk to one family who was living on a limited income, but had found these workarounds, the Reams. Can you tell me a little bit about them?
Yeah. So Kiara and Joe Reams were this wonderful family. I think they have 5 kids now living in rural Iowa. And they were this very DIY kind of household where they're like, okay, we don't have very much money. Like Joe has multiple sclerosis. So he, you know, has a bunch of, you know, limitations in terms of what he can do. Kiara didn't get to go to college. And so like her ability to earn much income outside the home is not very significant. But so what they do is they like can and barter and grow a lot of food. So Kiara is incredibly adept at managing bureaucracies and things like this. So she figured out that her SNAP benefits could be used to buy food plants, right? Huh. So buy like tomato plants and things like that. So she'll plant a couple of big gardens. She goes and she barters at farmers markets. She makes soap and will barter for like more flour, sugar, things like that. She does face painting to earn extra income. So they're incredibly plucky and care a lot about their food, right? They don't have very much money.
But it sounds like food really becomes a full-time job.
It was incredibly disheartening to feel like the only way you can eat a healthy diet when you're poor is that you spend 40, 50, 60 hours a week worrying about food. That's not something we expect out of anybody else in order to get a healthy diet.
What stood out to me, there have been all of these efforts, like small efforts, but efforts to make healthy food more accessible to people who are poor, whether it's making your farmer's market accept food stamps or whatever it is. Are those programs not working, or do they not get something fundamental about what's happening here?
Well, access is absolutely required in order for people to have a healthy diet, but it is not a sufficient solution to fix the quality of diet in low-income households, right? I mean, you need to have good quality fresh produce available to you before you can buy it, but you also need to be able to buy it and you need to be able to cook it. And that requires a very different kind of life than we typically are able to provide to low-income workers in this economy, right? So that's what the difference is.
So did you leave this project feeling optimistic or pessimistic about like what's happening next?
I mean, I think there are definitely some optimistic signs, right? The USDA has reformed its agricultural subsidy program. So we've changed that a little bit for the last 2 decades, right? We've spent something like 2/3 of our agricultural subsidies on corn, wheat, soy, cotton, and rice. So that's changing. So that's great. I think that there's ways in which that might mean we'll get more healthy food being produced in the U.S. at a lower cost. But for me, you know, hunger in the U.S. is fundamentally a problem of wages and work life much more than it's a problem of not having access to food. And that's a much bigger problem, right, than just putting a farmer's market in a neighborhood.
Thank you so much, Tracy, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tracy McMillan is an independent journalist covering hunger for National Geographic and author of The American Way of Eating. And we want to remind you about an event we're hosting in the New York metro area. Come be an audience member in the WNYC Green Space for The Other F Word, The Politics of Being Fat in America. The event is being moderated by feminist writer Lindy West. One of her guests will be Ashley Nell Tipton, the winner of Project Runway, Season 14. It's going to be an open and honest conversation about being overweight in America. Tickets are going fast, so get yours today at wnyc.org/thegreenspace. Or you can look for us on Twitter. We'll have the link to the tickets page pinned to the top of our account. President Barack Obama was the first sitting president to visit a federal corrections facility. He was also the first president since Jimmy Carter to oversee an actual reduction in the incarceration rate. Obama also presided over a rare bipartisan push on the need to address mass incarceration. You had the Koch brothers working with the Center for American Progress, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle working together. It seemed that real reform was possible or even imminent. Then came the 2016 election campaign. Momentum stalled, political risk-taking seemed to vanish, and as President Trump took office, there emerged an entirely different vision of criminal justice reform. Almost 2,000 inmates were granted clemency by President Obama. But Justin George, Washington correspondent for the Marshall Project, says people in the system who just a few years ago may have been feeling possible hope of release are no longer hearing that consensus regarding reform.
Well, you had, you know, two sides, obviously, who had agreed on many issues, including mandatory minimum sentence reform. But then you have the most contentious presidential election in recent history around the corner. And first of all, you know, timing is one thing. And you were proposing a major bill of criminal justice reform at a time when a presidential election is occurring. And if you asked anyone on the right or the left, that's probably not the best time to pass a broad measure because public safety is going to be at the forefront of candidates when they're speaking on the campaign trail. So that's one thing. But second of all, you have Donald Trump, who is, you know, very much law and order and making statements that essentially signal that he wants to sort of return to the way things were in the 1990s and the 80s when it comes to issues like the war on drugs. And that's backed up by the attorney general that he chose. So you have that going on. And then you have Democrats who felt that they had a candidate in Hillary Clinton that was going to win. What conservatives wanted is sort of a default definition of intent, so that in order to be convicted of a crime, you essentially had to have some level of willful intent. And in conservatives' minds, at least, they felt that, you know, the left didn't feel that they had to make any sort of concessions or at least go as far as they would like when it came to these bills, because they felt that their candidate was going to win. And that didn't end up happening. And I think all the issues that were bubbling underneath the surface during the presidential election actually infected this bipartisan coalition. And so now you have, you know, sort of both sides that are still working together, but, you know, the momentum has been lost. And I think that there needs to be some fence mending before it moves forward.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions is at the center of all this. He's made public positions on everything from consent decrees on police reform in cities across the United States. He is on the record talking about local control of everything from voting rights to, you know, racial policies and prison policies. How does Sessions weigh in on the question of incarceration and sentencing reform?
Well, so far, he has directed the U.S. attorneys across the United States to, you know, go after the most provable, harshest sentence allowed, which many say is sort of a return to sort of the Attorney General Ashcroft days or the Bush era. And a lot of the reforms, or at least this movement away from mandatory minimum sentences, is no longer going to be something that the federal authorities consider.
What aspects of the Republican program have changed now that the White House is seen as a law and order advocate?
Well, obviously, issues related to illegal immigration, you know, any criminal justice sort of matters associated with that. I think drugs, you know, drug crimes are now back on the table as being something that could end up with a mandatory minimum sentence. That was something that had been excluded. And sort of everyone had agreed that when it came to sort of small time and nonviolent drug offenders, that they should not be subject to mandatory minimums. Well, now you have a prosecutorial order from Jeff Sessions saying that, you know, all crimes need to be dealt with, you know, in the harshest manner and most provable way possible. So I think those are the two main areas where you're seeing a major difference.
Any names that were public compromisers and reformers who suddenly run for the hills?
You know, I wouldn't say that, but I think you are seeing some senators and certainly, you know, some congressmen who are supporting sort of different issues or maybe different take. You're seeing actually mandatory minimum sentences being proposed when it comes to the issue of illegal immigration. And senators and representatives who had been on board being against mandatory minimums now are moving towards that. So I think that's an influence that's coming from the influence of the White House. And obviously, Republicans are sort of marching in line with that. Now, that's certainly not true with everybody. You still have the reformers, you know, such as Rand Paul and Senator Mike Lee, you know, who believe what they do and have not wavered on sort of their belief that reforms need to be passed.
You had politicians on both sides of the aisle saying over the last few years that it was an embarrassment and a shame to the rest of the world just how many people were in jail in the United States and how many of them were African American. And I think there was possibly a feeling that things were going to turn around and that, you know, releases and parole reform and that sentencing reform was going to start to reduce that population. What's your sense that that's even possible now?
You know, I'm not sure that it is. You know, until you have the president's backing or you have Republican leaders able to sort of make this a bipartisan effort that they can sort of say, hey, this is something that we're working together on, and maybe that is one way that you'll have a path forward with criminal justice reform. But until that happens right now, you know, you have people on the right and the left who are saying that maybe the best thing is just sort of holding your ground, you know, hunkering down and sort of just hoping that progress isn't rolled back. And in the meantime, focus your efforts on state reforms, which are taking place in states like Texas and in Louisiana.
Justin George is Washington correspondent for the Marshall Project. Justin, thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
And that's our program for today. Remember, we love to hear from you on this historic day or any other. Give us your take on the news. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or find us on Twitter or Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.